Five, four, three, two, one.
Bazinga.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Now Showing podcast. I'm your host, as always, Sam Houston. I'm joined once again by my wonderful co-host, Lewis. Today, we're going to be looking at the main films we're going to be looking at will be the Super Mario Bros. Movie, which is an adaptation of the popular video game series by Illumination, the people that brought you Minions and Minions 2. And alongside that, we're also going to be doing Renfield, which is a new look at the Dracula story told through his sidekick, Renfield, played by Nicholas Hoult in this adaptation, and featuring a performance by Nicolas Cage as Dracula, which sounds like something we've all been dreaming of. We didn't know how much we wanted. But aside from that, we'll also be discussing a few of the films that we didn't record, we didn't get the chance to review during our hiatus, our last 6 weeks since we last recorded, which, so our reviews are going to be including the likes of Shazam, Creed 3, John Wick, and more. So we'll get around to that when we get around to that. But first of all, Lewis, it's been a while, man. How are you doing?
It has. It's been a long time, and I'm doing well, thank you. I do want to say I cannot find the tripod for my mic, so I'm holding it with my hand. So if there are any audio issues, I do apologize. But other than that, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I think, you know, it's a shame that we're not able to get any episodes out over the last 6 weeks, but you know, personal lives have got in the way.
Life happens.
Life has happened, which is rather unfortunate. But I think, you know, we were discussing this. I think if any time to kind of go quiet, we kind of picked the best time because there wasn't really that much out. Like I said, the things that we're going to talk about later. John Wick, obviously decently big. Shazam, you know, is a superhero film. Ant-Man. But nothing really that you know, we're going to be gutted that we didn't get to talk about. So I guess, you know, any time to have some time off, we picked a good time. We failed to ever talk about the Oscars. We didn't get an opportunity to look back at that, like we did the preview of it, but we didn't do the review. So, we're not going to talk about the Oscars today because it's just been so long. But can you just kind of give a one sentence view of the Oscars, please?
I like the Oscars. Almost every award was great. What about you? What would your one sentence review as the Oscars be?
I do not disagree with any of the picks, but almost all of them were the boring option, and I wouldn't have chosen them if I had the option. Hashtag justice for Paul Mescal.
Yeah, that's
hashtag
true.
Justice for Austin Butler.
Justice for Stephanie Hsu.
Yeah,
justice for anyone other than Jamie Lee Curtis.
Let's go, Jamie Lee Curtis. Yeah, okay. She didn't deserve it at all. Like, and I understand that, but I also am happy to say I live in a world where Jamie Lee Curtis is an Oscar winner.
So. I guess so.
Okay. Let's kick into Drive. Let's get this shit going, right? By starting off with the thing we do every episode, we're going to be doing what we've watched. It's been a while, so you think I've had a lot to talk about, but I haven't seen that many films, so it's actually very short. I imagine yours will be quite a lot longer. So I'm going to discuss Women Talking later on, something I'll do that now. But me and Lewis, while we were watching the Oscars together, watched Creature from the Black Lagoon together, which is one of the later additions to the Universal Monsters, Classic Monsters franchise, which includes Frankenstein and Dracula and the like. I very much enjoyed Creature of the Black Lagoon. I thought it was very good, campy, schlocky fun. You enjoyed it, I think, quite a bit less than that?
Yeah, I thought it was good, but it's not aged very well, I don't think.
No, I think that's a fair thing to say. I think that's a fair comment.
Yeah.
I watched a lot of the Oscars shorts, including, so I think this year, to be honest with you, I've always been big on the Oscars shorts. I still have got a few to watch. But it's really been quite an underwhelming year compared to the last few. Nothing really stands out. Some good fun in there, like An Ostrich Told Me the World is Fake, and I think I believe it. It's such a kind of redundant meta commentary, kind of Matrix-y, Truman Show-y. Like, that vibe is kind of done to death at this point, but it is done in a quite funny way, and I like the way that it's animated a lot, the kind of clay feel. And I guess the highlight of the live action categories, documentary categories, would probably be, I think I very much enjoyed The Martha Mitchell Effect, which is on Netflix, which is just looking at the influence of Martha Mitchell, kind of one of politics' earliest girl bosses during the Nixon era. So I thought that was quite good. Other than that, I watched A Whole Lifetime with Jamie Dimitriou, which is on Netflix, a comedy special thing, sketch special. I think Jamie Dimitriou is very funny. I very much like Statler, Let's Flats. And I thought that A Whole Lifetime was very enjoyable. I thought it was a very funny 50 minutes. I watched Don't Look Now for the first time. The what's his name? Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie led horror from the 70s. For some reason, I knew it was like the reputation, how good it is and stuff, but I'd only seen very basic glimpses of it. So basically, just based on the cover art, I expected it to be kind of Wicker Man esque. Only when I first got in, when I got into the film, I started to think that, you know, I was watching Don't Look Now like it was The Exorcist, but what I should have been doing was watch Don't Look Now like it's The Shining. I was going in there with a very different mindset of like what the narrative and what events meant and how they were being done. And now I realize that it's a lot more of a Shining vibe than I was watching it in the wrong way, essentially. It's much more of a Shining vibe than an Exorcist vibe. But I do think, I thought Don't Look Now was very enjoyable. I didn't necessarily live up to the high heights that it had been set up for me, but the camera work, the locations, very, very, very good. Very, looks, you know, still looks wonderful now. The acting's strong. The narrative is a little bit slow in places. Even though, you know, the film wasn't particularly long, some of it felt quite redundant or quite repetitive, but the ending I still thought was quite effective. I still felt quite scared at the end of it, so I thought, you know, it's a good film. I rewatched 2001 Space Odyssey in the cinema. It is absolutely excellent, as always. Just want to shout out that film. Oh my god, every single time I watch 2001 Space Odyssey, I forget how long the shots are kept for, the long shots of the spaceships and shit. I really forget, my brain cancels out actually how much time you spend watching those things. But still, one of the greatest pieces of art in general ever to be made. Me and you together watched the 1911 film Dante's Inferno.
We did.
Which is kind of, I think it was Italy's first feature film. One of the first feature films. And it was a really, really enjoyable spectacle. I don't know exactly if you would agree with that statement, but I just felt so much enjoyment watching this. But
yeah, I did.
It's essentially a series of vignettes that would accompany a reading of Dante's Inferno, I believe. I think that's the fairest way to put it. Like, I think it's very hard to follow the narrative of Dante's Inferno closely through just watching this film. But if you're familiar with the story, I'm sure it will work. But the effects and the visual quality of it is so surprising for a film that is, 112 years old. I mean, absolutely insane. So that was something. I don't really need to talk about those. That's pretty much what I've seen, unless I'm forgetting something. Oh, and Dracula. We watched Dracula. We and you watched Dracula today. Yes. kind of to count in with the Renfield stuff. And like, it actually definitely has affected my thoughts on Renfield to a degree.
Yeah.
You know, Renfield is a kind of re-looking at the Dracula story. So we thought we'd go back to the original. You know, I recently watched Frankenstein. We watched like the Creature Black Lagoon together. And then now this. So working our way through the Universal Classic Monsters. But yeah, I really enjoyed Dracula. I thought it was really well done. I think that, Bela Lugosi is actually as good as he's supposed to be. How do you feel about Dracula?
My list of stuff that I've watched is much longer. It's too long, so I'm going to skip over most of it. So I'm just going to give the highlights. As I've been saying every episode this year, my New Year's resolution was to watch more films at home and to watch every Best Picture winner. Both of them are doing really well. The Best Picture winners that I've seen since last time we recorded, I watched American Beauty, Sam Mendes' film, which was really good. It created this fake suburban life. Like on the surface, everything is perfect, but as you go underneath, everything's broken and really creepy. It created that environment really, really well, and the performances are fantastic. And the score as well. The score really stands out. It's a fabulous score. I also watched The French Connection, another Best Picture winner. Fabulous, like crime gangster film from the 70s. Really worth the hype. I thought it was fabulous. I also watched The Sound of Music. I love a good musical, so I watched The Sound of Music. I had seen it when I was a kid, but I hadn't seen it for a long time, and it is incredible. Julie Andrews is just amazing. She deserves so much more recognition, and she already gets a lot of recognition, but she deserves to be in the same conversation as the likes of Judy Garland when it comes to like the ultimate triple threats who can sing and dance and act and can do everything. She really is fabulous, and she's on full show here. Everything that she's doing is absolutely fabulous. And watching that Best Picture winning musical made me go and watch another Best Picture winning musical, My Fair Lady from 1964. And very controversial take, didn't like it. Really didn't like it. There's a lot of filmmaking going on in this, but none of it feels particularly special or passion driven. It feels like it's designed to make people go, oh wow, this is impressive, but not in a way that feels passionate, if that makes sense. Like, it's just a lot of stuff happening, but it all feels very calculated. So I wasn't a huge fan of that. Another Best Picture winner that I watched Slumdog Millionaire. Another hot take. Hated Slumdog Millionaire. It's a really ugly film. Not only did they go in with the piss filter, but it also, a solid like 20% of the film looks like it was shot on a GoPro with really low frame rates. It just looked weird. Didn't like it. And, you know, the performances were great, and the last sort of like 15, 20 minutes are it's a great ending to an average film. So I am baffled by the love that Slumdog Millionaire gets. Another Best Picture winner that I watched is Ordinary People, one that I had never heard of from 1980. And it's about this family that seems perfectly ordinary, hence Ordinary People. But they're kind of reeling from the loss of a child, and the other son, the surviving son, is suicidal and coping with depression, and it's the way that it's affecting the parents' marriage. And it's a really, really well-written film. It really is. It was directed by, I think it was Robert Redford. Yes, it was Robert Redford. And it really surprised me, because I'd never really heard of this film. So I was very surprised to see it. I also watched Moonlight. I got to see Moonlight in the cinema. I didn't see it in the cinema when it first came out. Got to see it in the cinema this time. And it's fabulous. It's genuinely fabulous. We watched Dante's Inferno, as we just said. Alleluia in the cinema. Don't know if you've seen the trailer for this. The Jennifer Saunders, like, British kind of, you know, that kind of film. Kind of like Phantom of the Open film. One of the wildest third act plot twists ever I've seen in my life. Came out of nowhere. Are you going to see it? Do you want me to spoil it for you?
It's not in my plans to go watch it. Right, like I'm not really thinking about watching it.
I will spoil it then, if you don't mind. So spoilers for Alleluia for anyone who cares.
Spoilers for Alleluia. So skip forward like 30 seconds.
Yes. So the film is about a hospital that's being shut down by the government, and the hospital is fighting the shutdown, saying like, no, don't shut us down. We need more funding. It's basically like the NHS is underfunded, the movie. But then in the third act, it's revealed that the main character, played by Jennifer Saunders, has been Harold Shipman style murdering patients for like 25 years.
Keep skipping, guys. Keep going forward.
Absolute insane plot twist that comes out of nowhere and doesn't really do anything for the film. Like, it doesn't make the film any better. It kind of hinders the film in a way, because the point of the film is that the NHS isn't perfect. It makes mistakes, but don't like stop believing in the NHS, fund the NHS. So I don't know why they made the protagonist a Harold Shipman style murderer. That was bizarre.
That's absolutely insane. I actually really want to go see that film now.
It's really weird, honestly.
That's insane.
It really is insane.
Don't say it again, because people might be not skipping.
Yeah.
Okay. All the Alleluia super fans that haven't yet seen it but want to see it.
Alleluia spoilers are over now.
That is insane, though. I can't believe what I just heard.
It's so weird.
That is insane. It happened,
and I was like,
I actually really need to see this now.
I know.
Oh my god, I need to put this on. I need to put this on in front of my nan.
It's so weird.
They're bonkers.
A few of the other things that I watched, I'm trying to be speedy because there is a lot. Raging Bull, yeah. Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull. Seeing that in the cinema was absolutely incredible. It's one of the best films ever made. Every time I watch it, I come away from it thinking that might just be Scorsese's best. But, you know, Thelma Schoonmaker, the editor, is the MVP of this film. The editing is the best thing about it. It honestly, it's unbelievable. Singing in the Rain, saw that in the cinema. Great, great film. And also, I am a changed man, Sam. I'm a changed man.
Yeah, this is insane.
This is insane. One thing I've always said about myself on this podcast and off this podcast is that I don't like horror films. But these past few months, I have watched so many horror films. I have found a passion for like low budget 70s grindhouse style horror. And it all started with Scream, weirdly. I binge watched all of the Scream films in 2 days and I just didn't want to stop. So I then went to watch a double bill in the cinema, a grindhouse double bill in the cinema of Wes Craven's The Hills Have Eyes and George A. Romero's The Crazies. And that was a proper like grindhouse double feature. Like, they played the fake retro horror trailers, and I really have uncovered this passion for like really low budget horror. I went back and I watched Halloween, and I have a very hot take about Halloween. I didn't think it was very good.
You're such a loser.
I really did not get the hype. I do not get the hype around Halloween.
Oh, it's amazing.
I really do not get the hype.
Oh,
I really don't. But then I watched A Nightmare on Elm Street, and I get the hype about Nightmare on Elm Street. Wes Craven has just got it. There's something about Wes Craven. I loved Scream, I loved The Hills Have Eyes, and I loved A Nightmare on Elm Street. He has just got something, and it's amazing, and whatever it is, I want more of it, because he's absolutely incredible. I then watched The Last House on the Left, another Wes Craven film, Wes Craven's first film, and it's really... It's very kind of weird, because you can tell it's a very early film. You can tell that he's not polished his thing yet. But all of the things that make him interesting in his later films, they're all present in this. So it's nice to see like a very early exploration of what Wes Craven would go on to do. I also watched Carrie,
great film.
I had seen Carrie before this, but I hadn't seen it in a long time, so I rewatched it, and it's really good. But the one thing that confused me about it, the one thing that really put me off, was she gets covered in blood, obviously, and she has a bath to clean herself instead of a shower, and I just thought that was horrible.
Good point.
I watched Friday the 13th, watched that yesterday, and I kind of enjoyed it, but the fact that you never see like the killer, it's always from their perspective. It's like POV, you are the killer, the camera is the killer. And I wasn't a huge fan of that. And the last thing that I'll talk about, I think, oh no, not the last thing I'll talk about. Sorry, I've seen a lot, and a lot of it is worth talking about. This is like killing your darlings. I watched Bodies, Bodies, Bodies finally, which was very, very fun, and I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah, I'm glad I watched it. I also watched X, the first part of Ty West's X trilogy. I did. I watched X, and I loved it. I thought it was really great. Mia Goth is absolutely fantastic. X is amazing. The whole cast is fantastic. It's a really great film. I really enjoyed it. I also watched How to Blow Up a Pipeline, a new film, and How to Blow Up a Pipeline, fabulous film. I genuinely can't think of anything wrong with it. I came out and I thought, that's 5 stars, that's 10 out of 10. And then I thought to myself, no, it can't be, it can't be. But then I thought about it and I was like, why can't it be? Because it is. Like, there's nothing I didn't like about it. It's genuinely that good, it's fabulous. I also watched Wall-E in the cinema. I felt like a kid again. And the last thing that I'll... One more thing before I say that again. The original Superman, the 1978 Richard Donner Superman, was in the cinema. I saw this in the cinema during COVID, and it was great. I don't remember it being quite as long as it was this time round. It really felt very long, but it's so charming and lovely and sweet that you never really care. They really don't make them like they used to when it comes to superhero films. It was just so much fun. And this is the last thing I'll talk about. Going back to my horror thing, I watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And absolute masterpiece.
It's great, isn't it? It's
one of the prettiest films I've ever seen. Absolutely breathtakingly good looking. The shot of Sally's eye with the tear in it. Ooh, it's gorgeous.
It's
drenched in this orange hue. The whole film is just very orange and red. It feels humid. It feels like when you're in Leatherface's house, it just feels dirty and disgusting. It's so creepy and weird and violent. Only one person gets killed by a chainsaw, so its name is slightly misleading, but I'll allow it. But it really is. It blew me away. This is what I expected Halloween to be. It's amazing. It genuinely just, I honestly can't articulate how good it was. It blew me away. Absolutely remarkable, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Apart from Scream, my favourite horror film that I've seen, Scream is still my favourite. Yeah. The original Scream is still my favourite that I've seen so far. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre is very, very close behind because it's just absolutely incredible. And that is not everything that I've seen since we last recorded, but it's everything I've seen that's worth talking about, I think.
Nice. Scream is probably my favorite slasher if you don't count Psycho. Mine also goes next to Chainsaw Massacre, except that I've got Halloween sandwiched between them, but obviously you don't agree.
No, I don't agree. I was really disappointed by Halloween. It was just nothing happens for the first like hour and 15 minutes, and then everything happens in the last 10-15 minutes, and it feels like it's not earned any of it.
Oh no, because the whole film's just building tension, and it all just goes pretty mad at the end.
No, it's just it's not. It just didn't do anything for me. So I remember when you came to mind for the Oscars and we watched the Oscars, and I said, has Jamie Lee Curtis ever given a performance that's Oscar worthy? And you said, well, probably in Halloween. And I watched it and I was like, no, she's good, but no, it's the whole film is not,
she's great.
It's not that good.
She's great. Okay, nice. It's really, the horror stuff out of nowhere is pretty mad. Especially that you've seen X. I'm really surprised by that. But I am looking to get
X. I surprised myself with watching X. Pearl is next.
Yeah, I think I'm watching Pearl on Thursday if everything goes to plan. Okay, dope. So, Lewis, I think you've got some... this is going to be a very Lewis-heavy episode today. Have you got some news for us?
I do have some news, quite a bit of news. Jordan Peele's next film is scheduled for release on Christmas Day 2024.
Damn.
Yeah, so we know Jordan Peele's next film. How interesting.
Nice.
Shazam 2, which we will be talking about soon, massive flop. Its opening weekend was less than Morbius, and it has made less money than Morbius in general. So that is abysmal. Abysmal. Barry Keoghan, Paul Mescal, and Denzel Washington are all in talks, I think it's now been confirmed, to be in Ridley Scott's Gladiator 2.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, what other films could we imagine that should never ever be given sequels? Because that sounds ridiculous.
It does, get sequels. It?
Like, it's like making a Titanic 2. Like, like Gladiator's got a sequel. That's so insane. Like, that's like making Taxi Driver 2.
It is. It's really weird. It's really bizarre.
Yeah. Like, if they made a Gladiator 2 like 2 years after, like, I think that would be like not that weird. But like now. So strange. Shawshank 2. Forrest Gump 2.
Another bit of news, and I think this is very interesting. Avatar 3. Again, talking about Avatar. Avatar 3, there is a 9-hour cut of Avatar 3. And
yeah, I've heard this.
Yeah, James Cameron is demanding that they finish the VFX on everything before they edit it down. And because of that, Disney are interested in turning it into a miniseries. Like, instead of having an Avatar director's cut, which is 9 hours long, they're interested in kind of expanding it and turning the director's cut of the film into a miniseries, which I think would work quite well.
Yeah, that's a pretty mad concept. I hope they cut it down a bit more. Like, because if it's the full 9 hours, that means we're going to get the stuff that isn't good enough to get into the cut.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, if they turn the 9-hour cut into, like, a 7-hour miniseries, I think that'd be great.
Yeah.
But, you know, trim the fat a bit, I think. But I think it's a very interesting concept. I would love to have seen that for other films. You know, like, the whole, the original Star Wars. I mean, I think it came from the fact that George Lucas, you know, isn't a particularly amazing director. As good as he is a screenwriter or anything. But, you know, he recorded, like, 150 hours of footage for the first Star Wars film. So, like, if we saw the first Star Wars film with a 12-hour miniseries or something, that'd be fucking insane.
Yeah, I agree. Some more DC news. Interesting.
Oh, again.
Yes,
DC
again.
DC news. Okay, carry on.
The DC news is that Ben Affleck will not be directing a DC film. Last time it was rumoured that he would be directing the Batman film, but he is not directing a DC film.
Damn.
Shock. Big news in comic book movie world, for Marvel particularly, Victoria Alonso has left Marvel Studios. She was the president of VFX and she oversaw post-production on films. And allegedly, she is like the reason that VFX artists are so abused by Marvel. Whether she's being used as a scapegoat, which I think is quite likely, or whether she is solely responsible for it, we don't know. But I'm sure she is responsible for it quite a lot, but whether or not she is the sole person, I find unlikely. But she has left, which is a huge thing, because she's been with Marvel since the beginning.
Dan, that is actually a very big deal.
It is, it's a huge deal.
Marvel's VFX has been very poor for quite a while now. And again, I think it's mainly because they're demanding far too much and then releasing loads of films. I think this news, alongside the fact that you said last week that because there's the new president of Disney, that they'll be focusing more on quality over quantity, which hasn't been the case in recent years. That coming in with hopefully a better situation for VFX workers, so they're given more time to work on films. Those two things, hand in hand, should mean that, you know, you'd expect Marvel to sort its VFX problem out fairly soonish, which is a good thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. Big Letterboxd news. Parasite has become the first film on Letterboxd to get 1 million 5-star ratings.
That is absolutely insane, though.
It is.
That is really mad. Because, like, I think, like, we did it on the podcast within the length of the podcast existing, it reached 1 million ratings or 1 million views, you know.
Yeah.
Now, 1 million five stars. That's just five stars. Like, almost every single person that sees this thinks this is a 10 out of 10.
Absolutely bizarre. Bizarre. Speaking of...
Everyone follows some asshole that's given it a half star rating or a one star rating on Letterboxd.
Yeah.
Despite that.
Weird, isn't it? It's bizarre. Yeah. And speaking of bizarre, Tommy Wiseau, director of famous Failure The Room, he's making a new film. It's called Big Shark, and we have a trailer for it. And I don't know if you've seen it, but I think it seems too self-aware. Like, the thing that makes The Room funny is that he thought he was making a masterpiece. Like, he tried to make a masterpiece. But with this, it's like, he knows he's shit. Everyone on board knows that it's shit. It seems too self-aware to be funny.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's directed other films since The Room, and he's definitely starred in other films since The Room. And the problem is always that he's aware of the joke. And that kind of stops any of it being actually enjoyable.
Yeah.
Because all just like Tommy Wiseau knowing that he's Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah.
Because everyone's told him. So, yeah.
Weird.
I'm sure it won't actually be very funny.
Yeah. That Vertigo, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, is getting a remake, and Robert Downey Jr. is in talks to play the lead.
Is nothing sacred?
I know.
Man.
I know. It's weird, isn't it?
It's nothing sacred. Vertigo. I mean, I'm sure the film will be fine. Like, the film will probably be like of Nightmare Alley quality.
Yeah.
But like, we don't need that shit, man. It's
Vertigo
like,
is not aged.
Keep your hands off Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Go do The Wicker Man again or something. I was fine with me, you know?
It's so
like,
weird.
Even good films like from the back in the day, you know, fine. But do some Like It Hot with, I don't know, Zendaya in it or something. Just don't touch Hitchcock.
I know. Especially Vertigo. It's just like, what's the point? Vertigo has not aged badly. Vertigo holds up.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
Yeah, really sad stuff. Robert Downey Jr. as well.
I know. Disney news. There is going to be a live-action Aristocats film. And
oh, come on!
Yeah. A live-action Aristocats film.
That's terrible!
It gets worse. Oscar winner Questlove is directing it.
Oh, man.
I know. Shockingly,
I mean, I guess he did do his...
Shockingly, not the worst Disney live-action remake news since we last recorded. I hope you're not aware of this, but I'm assuming you are. There is a live-action remake of Moana.
Yeah, I heard this.
Yeah.
Man, that film came out like 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, it's so weird. They aren't even waiting 10 years now.
They're not recasting anyone, are they? They're just getting everyone to play their voice roles.
I think so, yeah. I know The Rock is playing his character, and I think that everyone else is as well. It's so weird because it's not even 10 years old. It's not even 10 years old.
So, like, what is the purpose? Like, why does that film exist?
It's
like,
ridiculous.
What is the reason?
It's absolutely ridiculous.
Can anyone give me an answer? Like, what is the possible answer? Why is this film being made?
I know.
You know, obviously you can say money, but like, what is the unique selling point for this? There is no unique selling point. This film is not a new take on something because it just got made.
It's awful. It's
same studio, same actors, same performances. It's just going to be able to see their bodies. I just do not get it.
I don't. It's bizarre. That's it for normal news, but something big happened while we were away. Star Wars Celebration. So we've got a lot of Star Wars news to get through.
I'm also unaware of probably all of this.
Yeah, that is true. We got given an official timeline of the Star Wars universe, and each era has a new name, or not all of them have new names, but some of them have slightly tweaked names. So, for example, we have, in chronological order, we have the Old Republic, the High Republic, Fall of the Jedi, Reign of the Empire, Age of Rebellion, the New Republic, and the Rise of the First Order. Those are all the eras we have so far. The films that got announced were three of them. They don't have names yet. One of them is Charmaine Obaid-Chinoy's film, Oscar winner, by the way. her Star Wars film will be set after The Rise of Skywalker. Daisy Ridley is returning as Rey, which I think is great news.
Woo!
I think that's great news. I love it. She deserves so much better for Star Wars, and I love Rey as a character, and Daisy Ridley is fab.
Yeah, me too.
And it's about Rey rebuilding the Jedi Order after the events of The Rise of Skywalker.
Let's fucking go.
Yeah. A film I'm less excited for that got announced, Dave Filoni is directing a Star Wars film culminating the events of, and this is a direct quote, the Mandoverse.
Yeah, I saw people talking about the Mandoverse, which is a ridiculous concept, seeing as it's literally just Star Wars.
Yes, all Star Wars happens in the same universe, so why are they giving these eras verse names? It's bizarre. But yeah.
So it's just the Mandoverse is the Mandalorian and Boba Fett, right?
Yeah, and Ahsoka as well, I assume.
And Ahsoka, okay.
Yeah, and it's going to culminate all of those in a film. I can't think of anything worse, personally.
Lewis, did you see Andor?
No, I haven't.
No, neither have I. Okay, fair enough.
The last film that got announced, which again sounds really good, is directed by James Mangold. And it's a film about the first ever Jedi set before The Phantom Menace, centuries or millennia before The Phantom Menace, about the first ever Jedi. And it's been described as a biblical epic inspired by stuff like the Ten Commandments and what's the other one? I can't remember the other one.
Ben-Hur.
That's
Arabia, Ben-Hur, yeah. Oh my god, that is the coolest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
So I'm really excited for two of them on the podcast. And hating the idea of the other one.
Yeah, I agree. James Mangold as well. That is a really, really good choice. Really good choice.
I know.
And I actually was thinking recently, why do we not have good biblical epics? And I guess the modern day equivalent of a biblical epic is something like Dune. And I guess Star Wars is also kind of in that ballpark. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And that's it for our news. That is it for the news that I've got written down.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, man. I'm actually... part of me thinks I should get back into Star Wars.
I know. I'm assuming that at least one of those will be cancelled and never make it to cinemas. But hopefully not.
Hopefully not. Yeah, I think the fact is that you can't promise people a film about the first Jedi and not give it to them now, because that is such a cool idea.
Yeah, I agree. But that's it for our news.
Good stuff. One thing I didn't ask you, Lewis, before we start recording, that I should have asked you before we start recording, was we're going to be doing these short reviews. Are we putting a time trial? Are we putting a time on these?
I wouldn't bother. I'd just kind of say, like, keep it short.
Okay, sure. So, we are going to be doing, in this order, Shazam 2, Creed 3, Air, Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Amongst Thieves, Women Talking, and John Wick 4. Okay?
Okay.
So, starting off with more Lewis talking. And this is going to be Shazam Fury of the Gods. So tell me, is this good?
No, it's not.
Surprise.
Not shocking at all, but it's really not. It's very... It's not like Dream Big and it's fallen hard. It's very kind of by the book thing that just exists. You know, the performances aren't very good. Zachary Levi is playing someone who's like, I think he's like 16, 17, but he acts like he's an 8-year-old. It's a really bizarre performance from Zachary Levi. He's not very good at all. The CGI is a bit wonky. The villain performances are bad. The writing is very predictable and very eh. It's not very good at all. It's exactly what you'd expect. And it also feels like it got left for dead by DC, because obviously they're rebooting this whole universe. So it's like, we don't really care about that anymore, so we're not going to bother polishing it or, you know, thinking, should we cut this? Should we replace it with this? Should we do this? They just kind of released a rough cut. That's what it feels like. It's not very good. I wouldn't bother going to see it. which okay. most people already have not bothered.
Rating a man of the match for each thing, please.
My man of the match?
And rating, yeah.
Oh, God. Rating, I will go for 4 out of 10. And let me pull up the Letterboxd page for this so I can try and figure someone out to give my man of the match to.
Okay. Do you want me to start my Creed review while you look?
No, I will go with... Let's go with Lucy Liu for playing Calypso.
Okay, she was big up Lucy
serviceable.
Lou. That's... Wow, that is really a bottom-of-the-barrel choice. Not, of course, no disrespect to Lucy Liu, who's a legend. I mean, you know, the fact that you're someone only serviceable is being given it. Just want to make sure I haven't ruined my chances with Lucy Liu. Okay, Creed 3. So, I'm going to preface this by saying I haven't seen Creed 1 or Creed 2. but Creed 3 seems to completely hold up on its own. And almost all of the info on the film, all of the backstory and build up is explained within the film itself rather than in the first two. So, you know, everything you can work out that happens in the first two from context clues that's important is stuff like, you know, the nature of people's relationships to one another and stuff. So the story is completely self-contained. So anyone that hasn't seen the first two can also watch this. Creed 3 is my Top Gun Maverick. The way that people talked about Top Gun, the way people felt about Top Gun is the way I feel about Creed 3. You know, talking about like, you know, return to just fun action cinema and just the reason to just get butts in seats. And, you know, it's just harmless fun and not the same as this superhero crap. That's how I feel about Creed 3 myself. I think just a wonderful, you know, 2 hours of just non-stop entertainment. The fighting, the boxing is probably better than... I've seen all the Rocky films. Probably the best I've seen for actual... the portrayal of boxing itself. It's super entertaining, especially the final fight. I think, you know, technical level, a lot of the cinematography and effects used within that the final fight to differentiate between different moods and rounds, wonderfully well done. You know, there's a scene where kind of they become isolated in the building. I remember you saying you thought it was a bit cheesy. I think it looks wonderful. Performances are all great. Tessa Thompson is wonderful. Michael B. Jordan is wonderful. I forgot his name now. Jonathan Majors, who we're going to be talking about later. Really fun film. Paced well, tight story. Don't have any complaints, really. I'm going to give it, I understand it's probably not this good, but you know, for like the entertainment I got from it, I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. Absolutely loved it. Fair easily enough. Could watch it. Who's the man of the match? It's a very, very strong directorial debut for Michael B. Jordan. I didn't mention this is his directorial debut. It's a very, very strong first outing.
Yeah.
But part of me wants to give it to him for his acting pursuits. Part of me... it's a lot of people. I think I'm going to give it to Michael B. Jordan for his acting, I think, as Adonis Creed. So the easy option to say director, but I think it's for his acting. Really good choice. Really good for one of the best sports films I've ever seen.
Wow.
Next up, Air.
What, sorry?
Air.
Oh, that's it. Yes. Air, Ben Affleck's new film. I watched that one and it's a proper dad film. To be honest, even I loved it. It's a great film. It's really tight, it's short, it's snippy, it's well paced. So you never really get bored, but it's not like an action film where it's throwing loads of stuff at you. It's just a really well paced like business film. It's very funny, the performances are great, the direction's great. It's just a very fun film. I genuinely did enjoy it a lot, although it is bizarre at the end, because it's basically says at the end, the film makes a point of saying that Nike make their clothes and shoes in sweatshops, And I was like, oh, cool. It's about Nike and their business endeavors, and it's not afraid to criticize them. So it makes a point of the fact that Nike take advantage of sweatshops and abuse workers in the other side of the world. But then at the end, there's like title cards at the end. You know how films based on true stories have like sentences and words at the end telling you what happened after the film? And one of them was, you know, because of this deal, business executives now make billions every year on the sale of Nike shoes, while Born in the USA plays over it. And I was like, that is a wild choice. Born in the USA blaring on the speakers while it's pointing out that business executives make billions every year while children are being used to make shoes in sweatshops. Bizarre.
Is that not the point, though? Is it not ironic?
No, it feels like a wholesome thing at the end. Like, it's framed as like a wholesome thing.
Right.
It's framed almost like the big bad guys are the NBA basketball executives, and the good guys are the billionaire Nike execs who are fighting the good fight, trying to make people even richer by taking advantage of sweatshops.
I see.
Which is really weird, but it's regardless of that, it's still a fun film. It's a proper dad film, and I enjoyed it. So go and watch it. It's great. Ben Affleck is having so much fun in this film, and you love to see it. It rubs off on you, and you have fun as well.
Give me ratings of Man of the Match, bro.
Oh yeah, I forgot. Again, my rankings, I'd give it a solid 8 out of 10. Very solid film, very enjoyable. My rankings, I would probably go for Ben Affleck for directing it. As I just said, he's having so much fun in this film that it rubs off on you, and that is because of the way that he has directed it, and he directs the performances, his own performance included. It's a very fun film, and yeah. So yeah, Ben Affleck. Well done, Ben Affleck.
Okay, nice. Keep on talking, because we need to hear from you about Dungeons & Dragons Honor Amongst Thieves.
Dungeons & Dragons Honor Amongst Thieves. I went into this with relatively high expectations, because I'd heard very good things about it. And also, it was written by the same person who did the Lego Batman movie, I think. So that's high expectations for me, because I adore the Lego Batman movie. And I was slightly let down by Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, because it's one of the most predictable films ever. There's no, you know, especially when the whole point of it, Dungeons & Dragons, is like, choose your own adventure, it can go any way at any moment. It's incredibly by the book, incredibly predictable, to the point where there's one specific scene, and as soon as it started, I was like, that's going to be a post-credit scene. They're going to make a joke about that in the post-credit scene. And sure enough, they do. But yeah, nevertheless, though, regardless of the fact that it's very by the book, very predictable, very kind of lazily written, I really respect the filmmaking in this. It's really well made. It's got some really creative decisions. It feels really expensive. You know, I've seen so many behind the scenes clips on Twitter over the past month or so, and every single clip is just showcasing the practical effects that they put into this, the camera work that they put into this. It's a really innovative film from a filmmaking perspective, and that really impressed me with it. So regardless of the fact that I didn't love the story, I really respect it. It's a very fun film that it tries, you know, it's not just trying to be like, oh, we're only trying to get bums in seats, we're only trying to make money. There's a lot of passion in the filmmaking behind this, and I really liked that, and I really liked seeing that on the big screen. So I did very much enjoy Dungeons & Dragons. There are some great one takes as well, and as you know, I'm a slut for a one take. So yeah, it really, really did well. My man of the match for this film would be the cinematographer, Barry Peterson, because as I said, there's some really great camera moves, some really great camera work, and it looks really pretty. So yeah, I would give him man of the match. But as I say, it's very predictable, so I will give it a 6 out of 10.
Okay, nice.
What's next? Is it you? Is it you or me again?
It's me this time. I'm going to be talking about women talking.
Go ahead. Ironic, so, because you are a man talking.
That is true. yes, so it won an Oscar, right? It won screenplay. Yeah. Women Talking, Oscar winning, apparently. Film came out last year, but has still been getting cinema releases in the UK, I think in like March of this year. Directed by Sarah Polley, and stars an ensemble cast. It includes Rooney Mara, Claire Foy, Jesse Buckley, Ben Whishaw, Frances McDormand, and more people that I've excluded. And it is kind of as labelled in the tin. It is 2 hours of, or an hour and a half, of women talking. It is set on a kind of primitive, well, more like a, not primitive, but like an Amish-style commune, Christian commune in America. And is set around a lengthy discussion amongst a group of the townswomen to decide whether they should leave their commune to go somewhere else or stay in the wake of them finding a number of men in the commune to be rapists. Yes, so what I think of Women Talking, I feel like it's a film that I enjoy more in retrospect. You know, when I think of the film, I think it is very well written. I mean, the screenplay is wonderful and I enjoy the performances and it had a very good message and it was done really well. In retrospect, that's how I feel about it. At the time, I found it a relatively grueling affair at points where, you know, you're sitting through, you know, I don't want to sound like an idiot, but you're sitting through kind of very, very lengthy discussions at some point. You start to kind of disconnect with, and you kind of wish that something started to go along, or especially, you know, when you, there are definitely points in the film where you feel ahead of the character and you know where the conversation is going to go. I feel like it also would have been that problem would have negated slightly if the film wasn't so dull visually. I mean, it's a very bold visual decision what they make. To just kind of make everything grey and murky. But whilst the decision was bold, it is far from bold in appearance. And I felt like, you know, a film which is already quite slow, already going to be kind of vying to keep your attention. You know, it's going to be, you know, battling to you know, keep you from dissociating with the, or disconnecting from the plot. Having a choice of colours that makes you kind of feel, you know, less attracted towards the screen was probably a very poor decision. I don't know. I just felt like I understand how it goes with the vibe, but it does not make for particularly entertaining filmmaking. Despite that, you know, one of the best scripts of the year, and all the positives I kind of quickly skimmed over are all true. You know, the acting is all very good. I think probably Rooney Mara probably puts in the best performance there. But yeah. Lot of great performances, and I would definitely recommend everyone giving it a try. I'm going to give it a, for the reasons I said, the positives and the negatives, I'm going to give it a 6.5 to 7 out of 10.
7 out of 10, not bad.
Yeah, and I'm giving my man the match to the, I think Sarah Polley wrote it as well. Yeah, Sarah Polley's writing, slash Miriam Towles, who's wrote the original novel, and who can share the man of the match. But yeah. Okay, John Wick 4. I haven't seen any of the John Wicks. Is John Wick 4 any different to the first three?
I have seen John Wick 1 and John Wick 2 and John Wick 4. I've not seen John Wick 3, weirdly. Yeah, and the main reason I didn't watch John Wick 3 is because I watched 1 and 2 and I was like, these are very, very similar. I can't be bothered watching the third one. It's just like man shooting stuff and people explosions and fights and stuff. I can't bother watching the third one. So I didn't. I just went straight into the fourth one blind. And it's basically the same as the other three. It's just shooting, violence and all that jazz. Same as the others. However, this is the best that it's been. It's the stunts, the action work in this film is breathtaking. It's amazing. It's incredibly long. And you could cut out the entire second act and it wouldn't lose anything for me. The second act has, you know, decent fight choreography, decent stunt stuff, but it's the worst of the film, which is saying a lot because the film is excellent and these fight scenes are still excellent, but you could cut it out and not lose anything and it'd improve the pacing a little bit. But you don't really care because by the time you get to the third act, oh my God, the third act. Absolutely mind-blowing, the third act. The action in the third act the cinematography in the third act, absolutely incredible. Some of the, off the top of my head, I can't think of better action and better stunt work I've ever seen in my life. These stunt people were put through it. If this film does not get the Academy to introduce a best stunt ensemble at the Oscars, then nothing will, because this is unbelievable. The last hour of the film is basically one long action fight sequence along the streets of Paris and up a staircase, and it's just breathtaking. Every 2 seconds something happens that makes you go ooh, you know, it's just incredible. And Keanu Reeves doesn't do much, but he doesn't have to do, in terms of his range of acting. He does a lot of other stuff, but in terms of his performance, he doesn't do much. But again, you don't really care, because you're not here for the acting chops. You're here for the action stuff, and you get plenty of that and more. So it really is one of the best action films I've ever seen. But I do stand by the fact that the second act is superfluous. It could and should have been cut out. But again, by the time you get to the third act, you don't care, because it just blows you away. The third act absolutely blows you away. So I'm going to give this an 8.5 out of 10. It's really that good. And I will give my man of the match to whoever did the stunts on this film, which is, I don't know who did it, but whoever did the stunts on this film.
Okay.
It is the first name that's popped up. There are lots of names that have popped up, so I won't read them all out. But the first one that's popped up is Stephen Dunleavy. So Stephen Dunleavy and everyone else on the stunt team for John Wick 4.
Really nice. Very good stuff, guys.
Rina Sawayama is in it as well. And Rina Sawayama, amazing. In her acting debut.
Okay. Next up, we have Renfield, but should we? Yeah, we'll go Renfield next. Okay. I'm going to start Renfield and then you can follow. Okay. So, Renfield is a new film by Chris McKay, who is notable, especially on this podcast, because, or Chris McKay, I don't know if it's McKay or McKay, because he directed the Lego Batman movie, which is one of your favorite films.
It is.
And Renfield is a adaptation of the Dracula tale, very much so the Dracula tale from the original film, but through the perspective of his assistant, his familiar, Renfield, played here by Nicholas Hoult, and picks us up with him and his master, Dracula, played here by Nicolas Cage, in the modern day, as Renfield starts to question the morality of his own actions and starts to think about settling down as a well-rounded hero rather than a kind of creepy villain, as he's tempted by the love of Awkwafina's Rebecca Quincy. Okay, so Nicolas Cage's Dracula, what could go wrong, eh? Well, Renfield basically is what went wrong.
Ooh, snappy.
Yeah. This film is confused. This film is really confused in every way, from the cinematography to the plot to the random assortment of 500 named characters for some reason. This film has no idea what it wants to be. It hasn't made up its mind whether it wants to be a horror or a dark comedy or a horror comedy or an action film or anything, or a drama. It does not know what this wants, it wants to be, and it does not know how it wants to do it in terms of its cinematography, its framing, everything. You have paid Nicolas Cage to be Dracula. You have convinced him to come on board. And I even think getting Nicholas Hoult as Renfield, great, right? You've got this. You've got Nicolas Cage in a Dracula outfit. Use him. Make a Dracula film. He is so good at this. He's so good at being Nicolas Cage. And every time we've seen Nicolas Cage in this last, 2 years, he's either playing, a mature, serious character, or he's playing himself. We get to go back to Nicolas Cage hamming it up, but he does it in such a wonderful way because that is in the start, that hamming it up is kind of perfect for doing 30s performances, 30s characters, these big, you know, Bela Lugosi over the top performances, or even, you know, even Christopher Lee's over the top Hammer horror, you know, genre film classics. You've got him to be Dracula. Why not make a Dracula film? Instead, you've gone for a very unimportant side character, seeing it through his perspective, and he just isn't the most interesting thing about the film. I actually, you know, usually complain a lot about Nicholas Hoult. He's far from one of my favorite actors, and I criticize him a lot usually. I think he's fine here. I don't think the acting is the problem at all. I even think that the rest of the performance, like Aunt Grafina, is good. I think Bayman Schwartz is good. I don't think there's any problem with the acting, really. But it just feels like this is a real missed opportunity that you've got those names on the contract and you've come up with a far less interesting version of a film we could have had. Again, when it goes back to the point of being confused, there is far too much going on in the plot. This is not a long film. This is just over an hour and a half. But there must be about 35 named characters in this. And for what reason? Why do we need to fit everyone in here? It just feels like there's a lot of unnecessary guff and, oh, he's that person. Oh, from there. Oh, and him. Oh, it's very much like that. This could have been condensed to a much more simple story. And again, the whole thing doesn't know what it wants to be. There's so many subplots going on at the same time. Connections with the mob and his girlfriend and Dracula and, you know, links to the past. It's so confused about, you know, how it's going to go about doing this that, you know, there's not enough time to create actual connections to the characters, you know, that any character from them is zoomed through. And also, there seems to be massive jumps in the plot where we're supposed to imagine, you know, what's going on, because they've run out of time because they spent the whole time trying to focus on 35 characters and 35 storylines. Again, wonderful seeing Cage, you know, in this role, but you just think, you know, what could have been if there was a bit more direction here and if maybe we hadn't focused on the least interesting part of the story.
Wow. Wow. Should I go then? To be honest, I kind of completely agree with you.
Hello?
I completely agree with you. I think it's... Well, no, I don't completely agree with you, to be honest. I don't. I agree with you in the very large aspect of I don't think I've ever seen wasted potential as much as I have with this film. You had Nicolas Cage as Dracula and you did this. That's so much wasted potential. However, I did enjoy this. It was a bit confused about what it wanted to be. Like you said, it was a bit all over the place. But at the same time, it was fun. I had fun with it. It was over the top and gory and violent. And it was fun. And I enjoyed it. It wasn't trying to do anything revolutionary, anything new. Which, again, was a massive waste of potential because you had Nick Cage as Dracula. But it wasn't offensively bad. It didn't bore me. I was never bored. I found it fun and interesting. The plot was, you know, enough to keep me engaged. And I liked most of the characters. But my biggest gripe with this is you had Nicolas Cage as Dracula and you did this. But I question to myself, if it wasn't Nicolas Cage, if it was just some unknown actor as Dracula, we wouldn't be thinking it's so much wasted potential, what could have been. We'd just be looking at it for what it is. And when you do look at it for what it is, it's still quite a fun film that I enjoyed. So I'm not offended by it. I'm not bored by it. It's a lot of fun. But the fact is, we did have Nicolas Cage as Dracula. And therefore, yeah, it's impossible to not think what could have been. It's impossible to not be sat there and think they're not taking advantage of the fact that they have Nicolas fucking Cage as Dracula. You know, the scenes in black and white at the beginning are perfect. They are incredible. They are so evocative of 30s and 40s gothic horror, like the original Dracula that we watched tonight, literally just before recording this. You know, some cases ripped straight from the 31 Dracula film. And it's done so well, and it gives you this tiny insight into what could have been, and you think, oh my god, this is amazing. And then it just never quite captures that incredibleness again. So it is disappointing. It was very disappointing, sadly. But at the end of the day, I still enjoyed myself, so I didn't hate it very much.
I think one of the problems I had is that I just don't think... One thing that would have saved face in this in a major way is that if I thought it was funny. And yeah. There were certainly a few funny moments here and there, but I think overall the film was very, very mediocre in terms of comedy. I really did not laugh much at all.
It wasn't particularly funny, but I think it was fun. You know, the fight scenes were quite fun.
I enjoyed the fight scenes. Yeah, I think the fight scenes were fine. Like I didn't really have a problem with them. I think they're decent. Yeah, but I just think that if you know, say this was a laugh out loud comedy as well, I would think that all of that's worth it. But because it didn't fail, it didn't try and be a laugh out loud Sandler style, you know, a joke a minute comedy. But when it did try an awful lot that didn't seem to land there. I think that would have at least, you know, not made the film amazing to save face. You know, I understand your point when you say, oh, you know, if this wasn't Nicolas Cage, you know, would we be so critical? Because, you know, we would be thinking of it as waste potential. We would just think of it as a film, whatever. I think that the if this film didn't have Nicolas Cage in it, I would be absolutely slating it as like one of the worst films of the year. I think it's very lucky it has Nicolas Cage in it, and it's very lucky that I really loved his performance. Because I think other than if it didn't have that, then this would have so little to justify its existence that I would be going on a lot more. So I kind of feel like I've got the opposite opinion in that regard.
I do agree in a way.
Yeah, I'm surprised actually now watching Dracula with you just before this. I didn't know, you know, while watching Renfield, just how much of it was inspired by the original. And I think that is kind of cool. It does show a lot of respect for the source material, and that is nice. But I, again, this film was a million miles off being anything that I'd like to watch. You know, again, I'm sure there's even a good version of Renfield. Renfield. I don't think you need to make Dracula. I think there is a good version of Renfield out there. But you really need someone with stronger level of focus. I think you can understand being scatterbrained when you're making Lego films, because the whole thing is there's a million things going on at once. When you're making films, you know, some sort of, even if it is a parody, when you're making gothic horror, you aren't allowed that same level of freedom. I'm going to give this film a 4.5 out of 10.
Ooh, that is low. I'm going to give it a little bit higher because, as I say, I agree with pretty much everything you said, but I did have a little bit of fun with it. So I'm going to give this a 6.5. No, just a 6 out of 10.
Okay, my man match is obviously Nicolas Cage.
Quickly before we do the MVP, something I didn't talk about, and I don't think either of us spoke about, was I think the costumes in this are great. Nicolas Cage is... Oh, Dracula's outfits are really good. They're really cool.
Yeah.
Which, again, just reminds you of what could have been.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually, by the way, just want to say, I kind of quick glossed over it. I actually think Nicholas Hoult was great, actually. I think Nicholas Hoult was really good.
Yeah, he is.
And that takes a lot for me to say. Just want to say that, guys. takes a lot for me to put my hand. I was actually watching this, I was thinking... I'm gonna even have to say on the podcast this guy was good because he's good. Like, he's not done anything wrong here. Like, I think he's fine. Like, he's more than fine.
Anyway, so who is your man of the match then?
My man of the match is Nicolas Cage.
Oh yeah, obviously. My man of the match is also Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, obviously. Do you want to take a kind of sad note for a second, and do you want to talk about Jonathan Majors? So, I think I want to talk quickly about Jonathan Majors because it's actually just the sense of time is what I find really fascinating. Really, is I don't think I've ever seen a career rise and fall so sudden, and it's a horrible situation that's happened. But we're talking about between the last two episodes of the podcast. You know, when the last episode of the podcast was being recorded, it was just as Ant-Man was being released. In that time, we also had Creed 3, and he was being universally kind of seen as the next big thing in, because in one hand you had, well, basically there are two types, there are two genres of movie right now. There are films that are about superheroes and there are films that aren't about superheroes. And he was in massive films in both of those genres at the same time. And everyone is attracted to him. Everyone was going on about how amazing he was. And then the allegations came out of assault, or it was assault, harassment, strangulation charges on a woman. Following that, he's now been seen as announced to be a suspect in a number of other cases. He's been dropped from The Man in My Basement. It's expected that he'll probably be dropped from Disney in the coming weeks. So from Marvel, you know, setting up as the main bad guy for like this era, you know, for these phases or whatever, for this part of the thing. I don't know if it's ever happened so quick. You know, we're talking about, you know, one of those promising careers in Hollywood 6 weeks ago. And now we're talking about someone who, you know, obviously rightfully so if he's involved in those situations, but we're talking about someone now who is not going to be able to get a job again. And it's just mad that literally within the space of these two episodes between the recordings, this entire career, you know, roller coaster.
Yeah, it's really wild and sad. And just terrible in every way, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's a horrible situation that happened. Just thought I'd mention it because of time. So let's move on to something hopefully a bit more positive. The Super Mario Bros. Movie. Before we go into this, what is your relationship with Mario outside of this film?
I do not have one. I've played Mario Kart Wii maybe twice in my life, but I've never played one of the Super Mario Bros. Games or anything like that, so I had no knowledge of anything going into this. And I know that's not the case for you.
That is not the case for me. Yeah, I think it'd be safe to say I have a different relationship to Mario than you, because I, as a child, I was a massive Mario fan, growing up with the DS and the Wii and playing Super Mario Galaxy and all the classic games you could buy on the store, you know, Super Mario 64 and so on and so forth. And then, yeah, I've always loved Mario games. I played a lot, as I said, as a child also. Weirdly, not because of the game or anything, not because of the film, sorry, but I also just kind of randomly purchased a Switch on the cheap, like 2 weeks ago or like a week and a half ago. And, so just before I watched the film, I kind of was getting back into Mario, because I've been playing a few of the games on there. I've kind of always had a connection to the franchise. So I think that is actually quite important to acknowledge going into a film like this, which, you know, is quite heavy on the nostalgia and stuff. So, yeah, okay. Would you like to introduce the Super Mario Bros. Movie?
Sure, I will do. The Super Mario Bros. Movie is a movie about the Super Mario Bros. With a star-studded cast. About two Italian plumbers from New York, and one of them gets captured by an evil turtle or tortoise called Bowser, and the other one has to rescue them with the help of a lovely princess called Princess Peach. And it's about their journey to reunite and rescue one another, and in turn save Princess Peach's Mushroom Kingdom. I think that's right.
Yeah, it actually really sounds quite abstract when you learn it all at the same time. like the whole, like, him being a turtle and, like, it's called the Mushroom Kingdom stuff doesn't really, like, affect me, like, because I'm just, like, used to it. But, like, it all sounds kind of bizarre when you take it out of context.
Yeah. So am I going first, then?
Yeah, I think so. I went first in the last one.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, this film is also doing amazingly well at the box office, right?
Yes, it is. It's made a fuck ton of money. It's on about 850 million already.
And it's expected to suit, like, this week hit a billion, right?
Yeah, it's expected to swoop past a billion anytime.
That's mad. Yeah, the ensemble voice cast that you mentioned includes Chris Pratt as Mario, Anya Taylor-Joy as Princess Peach, Charlie Day as Luigi, Jack Black as Bowser, Keegan-Michael Key as Toad, Seth Rogen as Donkey Kong, Fred Armisen as Cranky Kong, and Kevin Michael Richardson as Kamek.
Big cast. And is it worth it? In short, yeah, it's a fun film. I enjoyed it. I feel like we say it, it's very heavy on the nostalgia and the gaming Easter eggs, all of which went over my head. But I feel like it did a good job of holding your hand through all of that. I never felt lost or confused. It's a fun film. It's really well animated. The animation is gorgeous. The voice performances are pretty good as well. All that's pretty good. The story, it's very simple. A bit too simple. I know this is a kids' film, but, you know, I feel like they could have added a bit more. It felt too short, almost. It needed something more to kind of join the dots together. One thing that did confuse me, I don't know how this works in the game, is the Rainbow Road sequence. It just kind of pops up out of nowhere, and they drive on it, and then they stop driving on it, and it's like, what? Where did that come from? It's not like they said that they'd established that there's a Rainbow Road that connects the place where they are to the place they want to be. They just kind of say, you know, they walk to a place and then say, oh, we need to be there, but we don't have time to walk. It's all right. We'll drive. And then all of a sudden there's a road in the sky that comes out of nowhere and is not explained and never gets mentioned. And I feel like even a throwaway line of like, oh, we'll take the famous Rainbow Road would have sufficed. But no, it just kind of shows up and then goes away. And I feel like it needed some kind of more of a plot with that, you know, second act. But other than that, it's a solid film. It holds up to itself. I enjoyed it. I think it didn't do a very good job, though, of kind of explaining the game. Like, in games, you get power-ups, and they literally just say, you get power-ups. And I feel like it would have been nicer to have had a bit more of a creative way to include the power-ups in the story, rather than just saying, you get a power-up. It would have been more interesting for them to do it like that, in my opinion. But other than that, yeah, it's fun. It's fun. It's nothing special. I think it's a bit too simple. But in a way, that kind of plays into its favour, because it allows you to just kind of turn your brain off and enjoy this fun for a bit. It didn't. I've seen a lot of people complaining that it only works. It's only enjoyable if you're a huge fan of the games. I didn't find that, because I enjoyed it and I've never played the games. I enjoyed it. It was pretty good. It was decent. It's not like revolutionary. It's not groundbreaking. But I don't think it was trying to be. It was just trying to be a fun little kids film. And it was a fun little kids film that I'm sure children will love. My nephew loved it. And he's a big Mario fan. So yeah. And you're a big Mario fan. Did you love it?
Yes, Lewis, I did love this film. The weird thing is that we have very different opinions of, well, very different experiences of Mario, have come up with very similar opinions, especially since this is a film that is very heavy on those things, on those references and those in-jokes and stuff. I would say I almost feel guilty about the degree to which I enjoyed this film. Because, you know, especially when you're criticizing things like Star Wars or Marvel for being so heavy on just, pumping you full of nostalgia and just giving you, like, handy references and callbacks. Despite saying all those things for every other film, watching this, I was just kind of smiling and going, oh, look, it's that thing from that thing. And, oh, it's that thing from there. And, oh, I remember that. And, oh, look, they put that in the background. And me staring around in the background of every scene trying to find things. A part of me feels guilty for the amount I enjoy doing that. But I'm just going to be up there. Straight up, I loved watching this film because of that. You know, I thought it was a really good, exploration of my childhood and shit. And it's like, it's just fun to be in that world. And it's fun to, like, especially when you have an animation style like that, you know, if you were doing this like Bob Hoskins style live action version, you wouldn't be able to have all that visual splendor and all that detail. you know, doing it with, you know, his style is, you know, it works a lot better. Illumination, you know, the animated this, the animation looks flawless. The animation looks really, really good in this. Illumination, I'm not someone that I would often, praise. I've released almost entirely shit, with the exception of Sing 2, which is wonderful, before this. Sing 2 is actually really
that's
good.
That's a really unexpected opinion to have. Like, all the Illumination films are shit, apart from the sequel of Sing.
Sing 2 is really good. Yeah, the voice acting is great. I don't like Jack Black at all, and him singing his little song cringed me the fuck out, but I got over it, and I could get on with it. Also, why do they bother casting Keegan-Michael Key as Toad when you cannot hear his voice in it at all? I don't know why they just cast some of the high-pitched voice. But, it's safe, you know, in terms of narrative. It's a very much a very traditional plot. It's a very, you know, you could have probably got an AI to write the outline of the story here. But it's the jokes, it's the visuals, it's the references, it's the just kind of childish fun that this film has that makes you kind of forget about the kind of narrative deficiencies it may have. It's a really good fun time. I know it's obviously a kids film, but my screening was literally entirely adults. There was not a single child in my screening. And
that reminds me, once you finished, I have something to say.
Yeah. And I'm going to be honest with you, I'm going back again this week. I'm watching it again, you know. I liked it that much. It's just such an easy watch. 93 minutes of colour. If you don't like the games, you know, you can have slightly less to connect with. If you're easily annoyed by kind of obnoxious Americanisms, you know, is a little bit kind of cheesy in that regard. But if you're down for a fun time, if you're an enjoyer of Sing 2, come along, because it's a really nice 90 minutes. And I'll say, from a perspective of someone that's really has been into the game stuff, one of the most interesting things, and one of the things that attracted me the most to it, was finding out how they could use kind of creative ways to take things from the games and somehow make them work in a film and make them work in the situation, work in, you know, narrative situations. Like, even though you just moaned about it, an example would be Rainbow Road, which is like just a Mario Kart track. It's got nothing to do with like any, it's never had a plot or an explanation or existence in the world ever. And they've still somehow managed to taken that like super iconography for Mario and still put it into the game. Or the fact they found a way to put karting into the film is interesting. Or the way they include Donkey Kong's world, all that stuff. I thought it was really just like working out how they were going to kind of include these elements within a very different media. I think it was very interesting. So yeah, I was a big fan of the Mario film. I was a really big fan of the Mario film, actually.
I'm glad. Like, speaking of your audience being all adults, mine was as well. And mine was full of, I can only describe them as the Nintendo equivalent of Disney adults. A lot of people dressed up as Nintendo, as like Mario characters. And every time something happened, like if something from the game popped up, obviously I didn't recognize it, but people going like, "Oh my god, there's that!" out loud. And like, people were gasping and like laughing out loud, grown adults like going, when something from the game popped up. And I was like, this isn't really, this is really like,
okay. Well, I like Mario. You know,
bizarre.
Like,
bizarre.
I like Mario in the same way that I like Futurama and shit. Like, I'm not gonna be in there. I don't like Mario like I like Arsenal. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like I'm gonna be in there like, waving flags and shit.
But that's what I mean. That's like, mad. Something had happened and they'd go, "Oh my god!"
I had a couple like, people oh, like that god. In my Detective Pikachu screening, actually.
Really?
Yeah, not to that extent, because it's like kind of pre like the Marvelification of cinema, but like, this is like before people had the gall to do that in the UK cinema, but we did kind of have like some fedora wearing kind of Reddit guys in there, like they were like making jokes out loud about the Pokemon references.
Yeah, that's what this was like, which was very not awkward to, like, to stereotype sit through.
Guys.
No,
yeah,
not to stereotype fedora wearing Reddit guys.
Yeah.
But yeah. So what would you rate the Super Mario Bros. Movie?
Probably like a solid 10.
Wow.
No, not really. Probably like, I'll probably like, I think, you know, you've got to think for enjoyment, but again, you know, it's not a perfect narrative feature or anything. It's no Citizen Kane. Ratings on a curve. I'm going to say an 8. I'm going to go for an 8. It's an 8.
Really? That is low. I expected you to at least give it a 9.
8.5. Give it an 8.5.
Wow, fair enough. I'm going to go for a 7 out of 10.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. That's more than fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
What about the MVP, the man of the match? I'm very, very conflicted about this one.
Yeah, I'm not going to say the screenplay, because even though it is fun, some of the dialogue is a little bit cheesy. But I know it's a kids' film. I'm going to say Charlie Day, actually. I'm going to say Charlie Day. He's Luigi. I think he's not in the film that much from like the second act, but he's in a lot of the beginning and the end. And I like Charlie Day a lot. And I think I really liked his performance as Luigi. I thought it was a really nice take on the character. I think he was good. I liked him.
Nice. I am going to go for Brian Tyler, who composed the score, because I thought the score was pretty great.
Yeah, forgot to mention that. Fucking world-class score. Apparently
it's full of music from the games as well, which is nice for fans of the games. Yeah. But even me, who isn't familiar with any of that, thought the score was fabulous.
Yeah, it's a really nice... I thought it was really well done. That it was like almost all of the music was Mario music, but it was all like tucked into like a big, it'll be like some like 8-bit melody that is kind of like you can hear it in the background of a massive orchestral piece, or it's like a different take on it. It was always like, you know, it'd be like a country version of or something, or
a
disco version of, so it's always like different takes on the original music. So I thought that's cool. That was class. And it means that Nintendo have to release a soundtrack, and they notoriously hate releasing soundtracks for anything they make. So, but because this is a movie, they're actually going to have to release a soundtrack.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Great stuff. Really good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, once again, me and you agreeing on stuff, eh?
I know. What a bizarre concept that is.
Who'd have thunk it?
Appreciate it while it lasts, because we don't agree often.
So, you know how me and you are, like, really positive about that? We're like, oh, that's a cool, like, new genre, and, like, oh, it's a good, not cool new genre, but a cool, like, new addition to the genre, and, like, oh, it's that's a really good fun, all that stuff.
Yeah.
This is how people probably felt after watching Iron Man in, like, the mid-2000s. We are here now looking at the Super Mario movie and being like, that was fun. Little do we know that in like 10 years time, like every film is going to be a Nintendo film. And then we're going to be like, oh, if only we'd known. And we'd like just slaughtered them then. Like, because they're obviously going to make a sequel to that, because they didn't include Wario in that. So he's obviously going to be in the sequel. So there's going to be another sequel. And then apparently like Seth Rogen talks about a Donkey Kong spin-off, and Charlie Day talks about a Luigi's Mansion film. And Nintendo said they're making stuff on other properties. So they'll do like a team up Smash Bros. Film with like that and Zelda and Metroid.
It's going to be huge, yeah.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, right now, I'm fucking hyped. It's going to probably end up being really cringe, and like, I'm going to get bullied for like, I don't know, like Jordan Luke McDonald probably about to start buying Funko Pops for it or something like that. But.
Wow.
But
so it's fun.
We can only imagine what's going to happen. But from our point, looking over the edge, not knowing what's about to hit us,
we're on the brink of something new.
Yeah, but at this point, it's all good. I like Mario, and can I have more Nintendo films?
I look forward to them as well.
Also, really bizarre choice of voice, I think, for Donkey Kong from Seth Rogen. Like, that is not how you'd imagine a gorilla to talk.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know what he sounds like in the game, but yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't really talk much, but like...
Oh, right, okay.
The songs, the Donkey Kong song is like sung in a deep voice.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Mario doesn't really ever talk in the games, really. Like he just like
well, he it, does it's... go, he does go, wahoo!
Interesting stuff, guys. Okay, I'm not going to make any promises about what the next episode is at all. I'm literally not even going to give like I'm not going to even mention a film that's coming out next week.
It'll be our Doctor Who episode. Could do this.
I don't know. Yeah, see you next guys in like another 10 weeks.
Yeah,
probably. See you know, you there's June. A good chance that an episode that gets released this time next week. There's also a good chance that an episode gets released this time next month. So
yeah,
you know.
We'll cross sorry that about bridge that,
guys.
When we come
to it. Yeah, I really apologize, guys, but life has been getting in the way here. Listen to that to the what we've watched section and guess whose life has been getting in the way. yeah, okay, nice.
Another episode under the belt, though, which is nice.
Anna de Armas, Lewis.
What about her?
Have you noticed how she's in really bad films now?
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I kind of saw that tweet the other day, like earlier today or yesterday, about kind of how bad her films have been post, like, Knives Out. Post Time to Die. Yeah. Deepwater, The Grey Man, Blonde, Ghosted. That's really, really poor.
It is. It's really bizarre that her career trajectory. It's wild.
But is there an argument to be made there that it's an upwards career trajectory, though? Because there's four bad films in a row, right?
I mean, I suppose because it can't possibly get worse.
No, I don't agree. My point is, Deepwater is a rom-com that went out on streaming services. A lot of people have seen it. The Green Man is an action thriller directed by the Russos. It was a big streaming release. Everyone saw it. Blonde got her an Oscar nomination. And Ghosted, again, rom-com, super popular. It's a film that's been everywhere this week.
I guess
like,
so.
I think that her career is in a better place from like her lawyer and is probably her lawyer and her team are probably happier than they were in 2021.
Yeah, her bank account is probably happier.
Bank account's probably not. Yeah, exactly. But you know, she's in a better place in the industry. But then, like, she's in a worse place in my heart, kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd agree with that assessment.
Yeah, she was quite good in The Informer, but no one saw that film. thanks for listening, guys.
Yes, thank you.
This has been an episode.
It has been an episode, that is true.
100%, mate. 100%. You can find us on Twitter at NowShowingPod. You can find me and Lewis on Twitter at SamHMedia and LewisJWR. I'll let you work out who is who, and you can find us in the letterbox Sam Houston and also LewisJWR. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to help us grow is by telling your friends. But if you can't do that, then you can at least, guys, come on. You've sat for an hour and 36 minutes. You can at least give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're watching this on. It helps us go up in the rankings, guys. Okay? I don't ask for much. Other than that, I don't really think, is there anything else that I say at the end of this episode? Or I can't really remember if there's any other.
I don't think so. I think that's it.
You can contact us via email at nowshowingpod@gmail.com, and no one has ever done that.
And no one will ever do that.
Thank you very much for listening, guys, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.